Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. In Kurt Vonnegut's novel Cat's Cradle, one scientist is a driving force behind the creation of not one but two ways of ending the world. In Vonnegut's vision, this brilliant man cannot rightly be described as evil because he only seeks the truth. But the story suggests that these definitions of evil and truth are dangerously incomplete. Joining me this hour for the Reader's Review to talk about Kurt Vonnegut's 1963 novel, Cat's Cradle, Jackson Breyer. He's Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Maryland, novelist Kate Lehrer, and NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. Since this is a reader's review, I do hope you'll take part in our discussion. It's an extraordinary novel that has resonance even as we think about 2007. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Hi,
good
Diane.
Morning,
Hi,
Diane.
Jackson Breyer, did you find this to be a funny book?
Yeah, I think ultimately it is funny. It's terrifying in certain ways, but it's terrifying in the ways that books are terrifying if they're recognizable. He tends to make fun of a lot of things, but the things he makes fun of are very, very relevant today, as you say. It's basically a book about, really, I think, three areas of our lives, primarily religion, science, and perhaps art, politics. I mean, certainly there's a good deal of relevance to politics, and I'm sure we'll say some things about that. But yes, I think it would be a mistake not to see it as humorous. I think Vonnegut himself, the whole tone of it is not to take things too seriously.
Kate, I'm sure this was not the first time you've read the book, but how do you think it stands the test of time?
Oh, it stands it gorgeously, in fact. It's absolutely as relevant today as it was when it was written. And it is the first time I've ever read it. It's one of the few Vonneguts, especially the early Vonneguts, that I never got around to reading. You know, I just didn't. But it certainly is just a brilliant book. And if anyone is left out there listening who doesn't understand black humor, this is the book to learn on.
Joe Palca, how about you? First time?
Yeah, it was the first time. But as I read it, I had a very familiar feeling, like I had been here before. Either it was because it resonated so much with Slaughterhouse-Five and some of the tone, or because, as Kate just said, standing the test of time, some of these characters feel very present to me. Having just met a bunch of Nobel laureates, one of the lead character, whom of course is dead by the time the book begins.
Exactly.
But they're interesting to listen to because they are sort of intensely intelligent people, but not as disconnected from the world as Felix Honecker, I guess that's his name.
His name. The novel opens with the narrator's effort to write a book called The Day the World Ended. What's he trying to do, Kate?
Well, he plays on words and meanings all the way through this book. And The Day the World Ended is going to be his book about Felix Honecker and the day, what people were doing, especially important people, including Felix Honecker, the father of the atomic bomb, the day the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And that's going to be the book he's going to write. Well, it turns out Felix, of course, has given us something else entirely. But within the first four pages at the end of it, talking about Felix and this, when the first bomb, they know at Almogordo, New Mexico, that a blast goes off, that the bomb works. And some scientist turns to the father of the atomic bomb and says, how does he say it? Science now knows sin. And Felix turns to him and says, what is sin? So he's totally amoral in his universe.
And Cat's Cradle, I may remind our listeners, I used to play as a young girl with string, and I'm sure you did too, Kate.
I never got the hang of it.
I could do it right now. Oh, yeah. It is a cradle. Sure. You played it too, Joe. Mm-hmm. And that apparently is what Felix Honecker is doing at the moment.
Well, it becomes a very major symbol in the book, because at the moment when the bomb is being dropped, he takes some string that he has in his office, and we can talk about the origins of the string, which are funny enough in it themselves, and he comes out to his son and demonstrates a cat's cradle. Well, this is a son to whom he's never paid the slightest bit of attention, and this is the only time he's ever played a game with him, and he says, see the cat, see the cradle, and of course the son, Newt, doesn't see anything. And
Newt is a very small
person. He's a midget. But the point is that all throughout the book, the cat's cradle, which is neither a cat nor a cradle, becomes a symbol for the meaninglessness of all the various structures that society sets up in an effort to invest itself with meaning, whether it's religion, whether it's politics, whatever it is. Newt keeps repeating that phrase, see the cat, see the cradle. There is no cat. There is no cradle.
The phones are open, 800-433-8850. Do join us as we talk about Kurt Vonnegut's 1963 novel, Cat's Cradle. Here in the studio, Kate Lehrer. She is a novelist whose most recent work is Confessions of a Bigamist. Joe Palca is NPR science reporter. Jackson Breyer is professor emeritus of English at the University of Maryland. He's co-editor of Dear Scott, Dear Zelda. I look forward to hearing from you. And the first story about Newt Honecker. Who is he? You said he's this little midget who is Felix Honecker's son, to whom Felix Honecker pays absolutely no attention. Why does he turn to Newt with this cat's cradle?
There's no explanation for that. In other words, it's just that he, as Kate says, he's a father who is totally oblivious to his children and who has never paid any attention to him, and suddenly comes out of his office and does this. And it terrifies Newt because he's never seen his father that close, first of all.
And he says he's afraid of him. He's ugly. He's hairy. He's not very attractive, Joe.
No, it's a strange moment. I mean, the creation of the scientists as being someone so disconnected and yet so brilliant and so capable of changing the world and so disconnected from it. I mean, it's an exaggeration, as I say, from the experience that I've had with talking with scientists, but you do sometimes get a feeling that when you're talking to people who are on a different plane from you are in terms of what they're thinking about, or if you want to think of it this way, the lack of common understanding, maybe that goes back to Jackson's point about setting up structures that we can all understand. If you're going to deconstruct the nature of atoms in order to build an atomic bomb, you're obviously going to be working at a level where most of the people in society aren't going to know what you're talking about. And so you're already starting. I mean, this is the trouble in translating science for the lay audience. You're always talking to people who don't know the language that you're speaking in. And so it's sort of interesting that here he comes with his foray into the English language with his family, and it's Cat's Cradle, and all he manages to do is terrify his child.
Well, but the thing is, Joe, that what Vonnegut says is because scientists deal in a language that we can't understand, they get a free pass too often in our society. In other words, people say, go ahead and do your experiments. We don't understand them. You might as well do them, and you don't have to explain yourselves to us.
And we don't have to understand you as a human being because you are so totally removed from that which is human. Is that what we're getting
that
to here?
That seems to be exactly what Vonnegut, one of the things he's saying in this, that we simply don't have any idea what they're doing, and we tend to respect authority and expertise probably too much.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful analogy that Vonnegut once talked about. His brother, as many people know, was a very renowned scientist. He had an PhD from MIT, and he discovered something called silver iodide, which would make it snow and rain, and he patented that. And during the Vietnam War, silver iodide was used to bring all the people in Vietnam. They sprayed it all over Vietnam to try to vanquish Vietnam. And he was appalled by what had happened to this invention that he had done in a purely benign way. And what Vonnegut is saying is that that's exactly what we do with scientists. We allow them to do whatever they do, and then we use their experiments for our own destructive purposes. That's what happens with Ice Nine in this book.
Explain Ice Nine very quickly.
Ice Nine is a device that enables water only to freeze at, to melt only at 114 Fahrenheit, so that therefore it can stay solid much beyond the point that normal ice will.
We've got lots of callers waiting, and we're going to have them join our conversation when we return as we continue our discussion about Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Cat's Cradle. Welcome back. For this month's Reader's Review, we've chosen Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Cat's Cradle. It was written back in 1963 and in effect talks about the development of a substance that can, in effect, bring an end to the world. And I'm not going to totally give away the entire novel, but what I do want to ask you all about is the scene in the cemetery, because it struck me that was such an important scene. John, our narrator, John, the man who is trying to find out all about Felix Honecker's life, finally gets to go to the cemetery where Felix and his wife are buried. What does he find?
As I recall, he finds this giant stone, tall stone, with the inscription, it just says mother, right?
Yes, and they
he thinks, first of all, he thinks that's Honecker's stone, but in fact it's his wife's stone, and his is much smaller and off to the side.
And why is that?
Well, for one thing, the children, he never got around to putting a stone on his wife's grave. It sounds to me it's a lot like the Washington Monument.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And he never got around a year and a half later. So the children take his Nobel Prize money, which he gets for inventing dynamite, essentially, the bomb, and buys this tombstone. And his is 40 centimeters square. Because cubed, I guess, because that's all he ever wanted. That's what he specified in his thing. But they build their mother, and when they get to the name, he thinks it's going to be, of course, the great scientist, the great God. Mm-hmm. And it says mother. And
Jackson, you tell an interesting story.
Well, there is at the cemetery a very huge monument that the cemetery owner says was created for a man many years ago from Indiana, significantly, who came through town, had this memorial created, and then never used it. And the narrator looks at it, and the name on the all he says is the name on the statue was my own. Well, according to what I've read, mm-hmm. in the first manuscript of the novel, Vonnegut had his own name in the manuscript, and then he just thought, he was told by an editor that that was just too confusing to readers and that it would lead them down a very sort of slippery slope.
He
called it his Ingmar Bergman moment, and he took it out, and he thinks he probably did the right thing because it would distract from other things that he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many. I mean, confusing. I mean, the guy who owns the monument business that makes the monuments for the cemetery is the brother of the guy who runs the lab where Honecker works, and it might be his brother might not even be Honecker, who's the father of the children.
Exactly.
Complication on top of complication. So of course, the monument that hasn't been claimed in the store is the monument that was created by the father of the author of the... I mean, this is the thing. You turn everything is connected, which is another part of the image of Cat's Cradle for me. You take a circle, a simple circle, and then you make this complex diagram by twisting the threads in a particular way. So I've always thought of it as the interconnectedness and the web, if you want.
Joe, I want to ask you about Ice Nine. Mm. And you heard Jackson's explanation of it. Have you ever heard of, as a science reporter, anything like that?
I hadn't until about an hour ago when I did a little bit of, I probably should have done a little looking earlier, but I was going online to look at a few things about this book. And there was a query to the New York Times question. That's why I'm attributing this, because I only read it secondhand. But apparently there are certain conformations of the ice crystal, which does make it denser than the normal ice crystal and therefore freezes at a higher temperature. But these are a matter of a degree or a fraction of a degree, and nothing like the 114 degrees, which is what Vonnegut was making up. But according to the article in the New York Times that I was looking at, this was discovered after Vonnegut had written the book.
Oh, I see.
And so it wasn't something that Vonnegut would have known, but that it was a prescience on his part.
Well, but how could this fictional Ice Nine become so destructive?
Well, I mean, if what he argues is that if you put a drop of any kind of solution that is we can call it saturated, but a solution will crystallize, in other words, become solid under certain circumstances, and he likens it to stacking cannonballs in a lawn. They'll stack in certain ways, and the crystals in water will stack in certain ways if you put a seed in, because they all want to be the same way. And in this particular case, the theory was that this seed would cause everything to solidify. Well, we're all 75% water, 80% water, so if you suddenly have all the water in your body solidify, You're now a statue.
Toast. Yes. Toast.
Well, toast. More like marble than toast.
Well, one of the interesting things about Ice Nine is that it was developed, apparently, by Honecker because the Marines asked him to find a way to get them out of mud. Which is a perfectly benign way, as I say. It's analogous to Vonnegut's brother having developed silver iodide. Right. In other words, it was a military usage which was perverted.
But even in the beginning, even with that, he doesn't really do it because the general asked him to. He just starts thinking about it, and it starts fascinating him because once it's in there.
It's a problem to be solved.
Yeah, it's a problem to be solved, and he just happened to like that problem for himself. He does pure research. That's the thing that makes it.
And not necessarily concerning himself with any consequences other than the problem itself.
Other than the problem itself, how would you solidify? He starts thinking about, because he doesn't, he says, you know, he doesn't work on other people's problems. A scientist or an artist, for that matter, is brought out someplace else in the book, works on the things that fascinate him.
You know, the second half of this book, Kate, takes place on an island called San Lorenzo. Describe that place for us.
Well, it's very, very poor, and it turns out it's been conquered over the centuries. It's out in, it's one of the Caribbean islands that nobody can live on. It's just almost impossible to live out there. But a man has gone out there, and whoever actually gets the island, whoever conquers it, and the next conquerors that come in, the people that are being conquered are perfectly willing to get out of there. I mean, everybody just wants out of San Lorenzo, but it's there to be taken. At one point, there are two men on a shipwreck, and the first is named, he takes the name of, what do we call him?
Bokanon.
So Bokanon decides to make a religion once he's there because these people have nothing. And he realizes once he and this other man who's with him, McCabe, and they say, we'll take over the island. And it was fine. Nobody cares. They take over the island. But that they better divide as entertainment. All they can do with these people, they're going to always be hungry. There's just not enough to eat. But all they can do is give them some religion. This is one that Bokanon comes up with and is all through the book. There's the Book of the Bokanos, many books of the Bokanos. And also they decide that they better divide for entertainment. Bokanon's going to be the good guy, and the ruler is going to be the bad guy, the despot, because you have to have good and evil just fighting each other. We like it that way. We like it very simple, as opposed to how life usually is, which is never quite so neat and tidy. Unfortunately, and Bokanon, because of that, is going to be censored. But, of course, everybody on the island, because he's a forbidden fruit and his religion is forbidden, they all believe in him. At the same time, if you're caught believing in him, you'll be tortured and killed with a hook, which sounds fairly ghastly, but one person had seen this. Gross. In the wax museum. So it's all, you know, fabulously done, except, of course, the despot, the tyrant, gets carried away finally and becomes essentially what he is. So they never have very many torturing scenes,
now,
they say.
On the plane to this island, our narrator so far, John, meets Ambassador Minton and his wife. And Ambassador Minton explains that he got fired from the State Department for being pessimistic. What is that all
well,
about,
at first,
Jackson?
John is told that he was fired for being a communist. And then he asks the Mintons, and they say, no, he was fired for being a pessimist. And it turns out that Mrs. Minton wrote a letter to the New York Times, which is the cause of his firing. And in that letter, she says, and I think this is probably the most relevant thing in the book for today, she says, Americans are forever searching for love in forms it never takes, in places it can never be. It must have something to do with our vanished frontier. And she says further, I was very upset about how Americans couldn't imagine what it was like to be something else, and proud of it. And she's considered a traitor for that. And that's why her husband is fired from the State Department.
But he ends that passage, too, which I think is just wonderful. She ends her letter by saying, after he says, like, she can't understand about Americans, it must have to do with the vanishing frontier.
Yes.
So, that's Vonnegut, though. That captures everything. He twists it just a little bit more.
All right. Let's open the phones and welcome our listeners into this conversation. 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Salisbury, North Carolina. RD, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Obviously, Vonnegut has come up with a story pattern after the life of Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's so-called Dr. Opp, who took his experiments out there to New Mexico and into the desert. The Spanish named it Jornada del Muerto, the journey of death, and the mountains overlooking this place was Sangre de Cristo, blood of Christ. And here we have an intellectual man who's studied Vedic Indian philosophy, and he doesn't get these ciphers and realize what he's doing, and he transfers his human responsibility to the politicians and the military men. Comment on that. It's about Dr. Oppenheimer.
Well, actually, it's based on a real scientist that Vonnegut knew when he worked at GE. After he couldn't afford to go to college or graduate school any longer, he worked at GE as a PR man. And it's based on a man, he admits that it's a caricature of a scientist he met at GE called Dr. Irving Langmuir, who apparently was the first private industry scientist to win the Nobel Prize. And he took many of the details about Langmuir and made him into Honecker.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Joe, do you want to comment?
Well, only that there is that temptation to look at Oppenheimer because of the role he played in the nuclear, the atom bomb. But, you know, Oppenheimer himself did have a conscience, ran into all kinds of trouble for his criticism of what he himself had been a party to. So, I mean, that's why, for me... For me, the paintbrush of the scientist completely dissociated with the moral and ethical consequences of his or her work. I appreciate it, and yet it's a caricature which rings true with people's preconceptions, and yet I don't find that to be the case with most of the scientists I've talked to.
Especially when you think of people like E.O. Wilson or Jane Goodall or Jacques Cousteau or people of that sort.
Well, certainly. I mean, you've named scientists with a huge social conscience. There is this sense, I mean, there is this question always of, and I think it's a reasonable one, what if you invent something that subsequently turns out to be useful in a way that you and no one else ever considered? Well, it's a little hard to judge someone for coming up with something that's intellectually brilliant but may have potential negative consequences when nobody's thought of the negative consequences. It's only the more interesting cases to me are when you're faced with making a decision about something where you can see in real time. I mean, like making a bomb, that I get, you know. But the question is, I was thinking as I came over here, what if you were trying to study influenza because we're all worried about another flu pandemic? And TB, right, just now. But thinking back to the flu, people are trying to recreate or have recreated the 1918 flu virus. Well, what do you want that around for? I mean, my goodness, it killed tens of millions of people. And yet, you can see a value for it because if you have it in hand, you can study it and figure out if there's a way to treat it. That's the moral or social or ethical dilemma
but
I find more comprehensive.
How about with the Manhattan Project and those who were involved with that? Certainly there were those who had consciences,
right,
who felt very, very strongly that the creation of the bomb was the worst imaginable thing they could do, and yet they were called on to do it.
Well, Joe mentions connections between this novel and Slaughterhouse-Five. Don't forget, Vonnegut lived through Dresden.
Yep.
Dresden was ordered by Winston Churchill. Just remember that. I mean, the destruction of Dresden was engineered by Winston Churchill, and he was very conscious of that fact thereafter. And don't forget, this novel in many ways is a post-World War II novel, and the horror of Hiroshima to people like Vonnegut, the horror of Dresden is what is uppermost in his mind. And certainly, as Joe says, there's another side to it, but he was living very much. I mean, he said he grew up as a kid who idolized scientists. And then suddenly he's in Dresden, and it's that very same science that blows up 135,000 people.
And he uses black humor to get at it.
Exactly. I was going to say, we can't forget that this is really satire, and satire always exaggerates the situations and gives you the craziest case.
But it has truth to it.
But has absolute truth to it.
At its base.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that that's what he has managed to do so well here, is to create that satire, to create that humor. But we all can see in bits and pieces where it comes from. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. Additional support for NPR comes from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty, online at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the rights women have lost in Iraq. We talk with the co-founder of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, Yanar Mohammed. She's had to deal with death threats and must conduct much of her work in secrecy. Also, we talk with our critic at large, John Powers, about this year's Cannes Film Festival. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. We'll go right back to the phones for our discussion of Kurt Vonnegut's 1963 novel, Cat's Cradle. Let's go to Miami, Florida. Hi there, Jacob. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. It's nice hearing your voice.
Thank you.
I just have the question, well, what was the point? I'm following up on the statements made about the conscientiousness and actual morality of scientists. What was the point then of legally crucifying Oppenheimer by the government and characterizing the other scientists as traitors who supported a moral and strategic issue after they had done this great service?
Joe Belka.
Well, I don't think that the crucifixion was done at the hands of the scientific community. So the point, I guess, was that the aims of the government were not served by criticism at that point. And it's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of scientists that aren't too popular with the current administration. So, you know, you can't blame. I mean, the scientists, as we've been talking about, the scientists will take refuge, and I think justifiably so, in saying, we found what is the truth about the natural world.
And
you decide. I mean, there was some that said, we don't need to drop this bomb on anybody.
Right.
We can explode it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I mean, well, that'll hurt some fish, I'm sure. But we don't have to hurt any human beings and demonstrate its awesome power, and people will capitulate. And that was thought inadequate. Now, you know, who's to blame? I don't know.
But is there a scientist, Jackson, on whom this particular character is paired?
Yeah, it is this scientist in some ways, obviously, as the scientist at GE that Vonnegut knew, who was so absent-minded that he himself actually left a tip for his wife after she served him breakfast one morning, which is a detail that Vonnegut uses in the novel. He also interrupted his research once to wonder out loud whether turtles pulled in their heads, their spines buckled or contracted. And right in the middle of his atomic bomb researches, Honecker stops and sort of muses about this. And the Ice Nine story is based on the fact that when H.G. Wells came to the GE lab, Langmuir suggested this to him as a kind of subject for a science fiction novel. And Wells never used it, and Langmuir died, and Wells died, and Vonnegut said, well, it's fair game now, I can use it.
All right, but go ahead.
Well,
Kate.
I was going to say, back to our caller's question too about why Oppenheimer was then, crucified, as he put it. That anybody that questions, remember back to what Jackson was talking about, Mrs. Minton, the wife of the ambassador. The ambassador Minton was called up because he was considered a pessimist, and that's any time you question. And these scientists then started questioning the validity of what they had done, the goodness of what they had done, then therefore you're a traitor is essentially it. Pessimism.
Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Pete.
Hi, I'm elated that you took my call. Thanks. One of the most interesting concepts in Cat's Cradle to me was the concepts of fate. In Baconianism, they talk about the concept of a carass and a grand saloon. And in that, a carass is a group of people that are sort of handpicked by God that sort of are always interrelated, even though they don't realize it. And a grand saloon is a group where people think they're interrelated, but they're really not. And I'd like to say that as a Cincinnatian, for better or for worse, I think I can testify that Cincinnatians indeed are a carass and not a grand saloon. As far away as I've been from Cincinnati, which includes Western Alaska and Bosnia, I keep running into them and sharing experiences with them. So I think that Vonnegut would find that ironic.
Hmm. Hoosiers. Right. Hoosiers make quite an appearance in the book too.
Hoosiers.
But I happened to be in Indianapolis the day that Vonnegut died, and it was like the city went into a kind of group mourning.
Really?
His photo was on the front of the library where my event was, and it was because he was expected to speak there in a couple weeks, in honor of his birthday and his. But he's from Indianapolis, and he's a favorite son there.
Interesting. Thanks for calling to Rochester, Indiana. Good morning, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always noticed that there's an undercurrent. The characters in Vonnegut's books always seem to mirror his own family. And while earlier in the conversation you discussed Newt, and I've always felt in Cat's Cradle that Newt was a surrogate for Vonnegut himself and his family. He probably, at the time that he wrote this book, he wasn't quite as successful as he became later in life. And he looked up to his older siblings. You always see this kind of a tragic older sister who is dutiful to the family.
Oh,
you know,
I'm afraid
it's artistic. And...
Okay, we were losing you there for a minute, Matt. You've got this 6-foot-tall sister, and Kurt Vonnegut's sister was a tall woman, was she not, Kate?
Yes, and in this book, Angela, the tall woman, is plays the clarinet, I think it is, mm-hmm. or the clarinet, yes. Mm-hmm. And she does that to soothe herself because her father, this great scientist, takes her out of school once the mother dies in the family, takes her out of school to look after him. So she spends her life just looking after him, gets no more education, and takes a little at the death of her father. All the children get a little bit of this Ice-9 they take. They're the only people on Earth that know about Ice-9.
That's their inheritance.
That's their inheritance.
Actually. But are they clear as to what to do with the Ice-9?
Well, they use it to their own advantage. Angela uses it to get a husband. I mean, she's a totally unmarriageable woman, and she marries this man by trading him Ice-9, and he in turn gives it to the U.S. government. Newt, who is a midget, trades it to get a few, I don't know, days, weeks with a Ukrainian midget. A Ukrainian woman. She's not a midget, as far as I know. And she, in turn, gives it to the Russian government. So as John says at one point in the novel, now both America and Russia have Ice-9. And they obviously have the potential of using it.
Here is a really an interesting email from Andrew, who says, "You and your guests are sitting there complaining about scientists unthinkingly causing problems, yet you and your cohorts need look no further than yourselves to view no better examples of people who carelessly cause trouble. You all routinely distort facts and mislead your viewers, readers, listeners, without fail, in order to further your political objectives. It's what you do. You revel in the phrase, 'The pen is mightier than the sword,' without even realizing the darker implications of those words. And what's more, you do it with a full realization of what your omissions and distortions bring about, whereas most scientists do what they do without that cunning purpose, in with noble purposes in most cases. You are hypocrites."
Well, the whole basis of Bokenism is all of the true things that I'm about to tell you are shameless lies. Anyone unable to understand how a useful religion can be founded on lies will not understand this book either. And, what Vonnegut is doing, it's an equal opportunity satire. I mean, it satirizes everybody. He would agree absolutely with what that caller said. All he is doing, and I think Joe is right, I mean, he is tarring a scientist with the same brush as he's tarring a politician and a priest, if you will. And he is caricaturing. As Kate says, it's satire. There certainly are scientists who are unmindful of the consequences of what they do. There certainly are journalists who are responsible.
And the children who inherit this Ice-9 are... Vonnegut makes, or John, the narrator of the book, makes the point that, in fact, we give the information over and everything this we say, as well as scientists say, to humanity, and most of humanity acts childish. And this is part of what most of us don't know what to do with any of it.
Here's an email from Kevin in Orleans, Massachusetts. He says, "When Edward Teller returned to Los Alamos in 1993 for the 50th anniversary of the Manhattan Project, he said he regretted his work on the hydrogen bomb because it had led to public distrust of science." Joe Palca.
Well, Teller was an interesting man, and I'm interested. I wasn't aware of that particular quote. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Teller was responsible for helping Ronald Reagan decide to pursue the Star Wars, the ballistic missile defense system, and he lost a lot of credibility among scientists for that, because a lot of scientists thought that that was a politically motivated choice rather than a scientifically driven choice that could be made rationally. But I'm sure that any loss in prestige is hurtful to scientists. That I can be pretty sure about.
To Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Bruce. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for keeping me delightful company for the two-hour drive I had today.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
I read Kant's Cradle 35 years ago, and it still burns in my mind that you break the skin of a toy balloon, and there you have a grand balloon. And you didn't bring up the Boko Maru on the island, which was outlawed so that the government could have something to do. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Boko Maru is the form of, I guess you'd call it, love that is expressed between Bokanists, where they touch the soles of their feet to one another, and that is considered the highest form of I guess, sexual contact.
Public display of sexual contact.
And there's an absolutely fantastic, I mean, rude as can be, and fantastic description capturing all of Vonnegut's ice wit, too, because he talks about at one point this woman who's performing this exercise with one of the pilots that comes to greet the Air Force that comes to greet him when he first arrives at the island, and he said she's rubbing his foot, and he had his features composed in the catatonic, orgiastic rigidity of one receiving the Congressional Medal of Honor.
But
how could you mix those images so quickly in a sentence? Wow.
But yeah, the other thing that he satirizes in this novel is love, because the sexual symbol in this novel, Mona Amans Manzano, who's the sort of adopted daughter of the dictator of the island, who is this gorgeous female that John lusts after, is absolutely indifferent to any form of love. I mean, he ends up being affianced to her, and she's totally indifferent. She'll give it her love to anybody.
Here is a fascinating email from Norman, who says, I was in the special engineer detachment at Los Alamos, and a colleague and I purified all the plutonium for the Alamogordo test and the Nagasaki bomb. If the bomb had been used for a test, demonstration firing, there was no more plutonium for a third bomb if it became necessary. That's why no demonstration was held in the Pacific, Joe Palca.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
I mean, this was at the end of a bloody and tiring and awful conflict, and it's easy to second guess. Who knows?
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And the question becomes, for me, as far as this book is concerned, is Vonnegut saying that scientists are more to blame than the bumblers, the politicians, and the random people for what may become the end of the world?
No, I think, I think he's an equal opportunity satirist. I mean, he's satirizing all the things that we hold to be holy. What he's saying is there are no easy answers. I mean, that's why Bokanism gets such a foothold, because it tells lies. And all you have to do is look at the epigram for the novel, one of the epigrams. Live by the FOMA that make you brave and kind and healthy and happy. And FOMA are harmless untruths. Now remember, harmless untruths is two words. Untruths, but they're harmless. And at the end of the novel, that's what the narrator is left with, to live by the harmless untruths that make you brave and happy.
Well, I just hope that our discussion this morning takes many of you to the library or to the bookstore for a copy of Kurt Vonnegut's 1963 novel, Cat's Cradle. Jackson Breyer, Kate Lehrer, Joe Palca, thank you all so much. Let me tell you about next month's Reader's Review on June 20th. We'll talk about the Charlotte Bronte novel, Villette. It's the story of a young English woman who travels to France to teach at a girls' boarding school in the small town of Villette. It's Charlotte Bronte's most autobiographical work, depicts a heroine struggling to preserve an independent spirit in the face of adverse circumstances. June 20th for Villette. And let me tell you, I'll be off for the next week or so, first going to Johns Hopkins for a voice treatment and then down to WUNC in North Carolina for a visit with all the folks at that station. I hope to be back with you in perhaps a week or so. We'll have Steve Roberts and Susan Page and others sitting in for me. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Andersman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.